back to another episode of The Hopeful Environmentalist, a podcast where we discuss hope in the climate movement and ways to take action with incredible guest speakers. It's your host, Taylor Gannis, and today I have a discussion with a very talented individual, Maggie DeWayne. In this episode, we talk about how poetry can be a powerful tool in activism, and we take a deep dive into her book, Haiku and Hope, which is a poetry book that takes readers along on her journey to visit all 50 states as she both experiences the landscape in its current state, as well as imagines its future. For information on where you can get the book, that will all be linked in the description of this podcast, and we also talk about it a bit in the episode, so definitely stay tuned and check it out. Now, to introduce Maggie, Maggie is a communications strategist, writer, and filmmaker who has traveled to all 7 continents to understand climate change, conservation, and how both impact people. Through short films, news articles, and poetry, she translates climate science to lay audiences to empower them to act. Her professional experience spans the U.S. Senate, White House Council on Environmental Quality, and environmental nonprofits like the Environmental Investigation Agency, and most recently, Defenders of Wildlife. She currently serves on the board of directors of Birdality and Advisory Council to the D.C. Environmental Film Festival, co-hosts a wildlife podcast called The Watering Hole, and leads an annual week-long seabird conservation summer camp in Maine with the Audubon Society. Maggie holds a B.S. from Seton Hall University in Diplomacy and International Relations, and an MPA from Columbia University in Environmental Science and Policy. Maggie lives with her dog, Argos, and can often be found playing soccer or planning her next adventure. Additionally, I wanted to quickly give some shout-outs on the podcast. If you aren't aware, I also am an author of the environmental children's book, Greeny LaRue and the Earth Crew, which is a book that has a mission of educating and empowering children to take action on the climate crisis. And the book will be released in September 15th and available for pre-order very soon, so stay tuned for that. You can sign up for updates on when pre-ordering is available by visiting www.greenylarue.com, which will also be linked in the description of this podcast, so you'll easily be able to find it. And you can check out the cover and more information about the book all there. But I couldn't have finished this book without the support of the wonderful people who donated to my Kickstarter campaign. So I wanted to quickly do some shout-outs, some names, and these are not a comprehensive list. There will be more people, so if you don't hear your name, stay tuned for the next episode. So some shout-outs include Felicia Carparelli, Francesca Mastriani, Teresa Benvenuti, Jen, Brittany, Susan O'Leary, Cadison Willis, Maria DeSimone, Liz Danny, Nora Mendy, and a huge shout-out to David Schmidt, who donated at our highest tier. There will also, again, be more shout-outs, so stay tuned in the next episode. But for now, let's dive into this amazing episode with guest speaker, Maggie. Hi, so thank you so much for joining us today. So excited to have you.
Thank you for having me. I am really thrilled and honored to be here. This is great.
Yeah, so I loved reading your poetry book, so we're definitely going to dive into that first. So, you know, your book, Haiku and Hope, takes readers on a journey across all 50 states. So what inspired you to explore the United States through the lens of a haiku?
Yeah, of course. I've been drawn to the expressive nature of poetry since I was a kid and first learned what a couplet was. Poetry to me is like such a permissible way to share your thoughts and feelings. And I'm sure a lot of other creative minds out there will feel similarly or relate. It just feels good to express yourself creatively and uninhibited. And haiku, they are inherently short poems, and therefore I think they have a unique staying power. And a memorable haiku, you can put it in your back pocket, save it for later, and enjoy again and again. So as I went through my travels, I thought it was a fun way to try to capture my experience and just one essence of each state in its uniqueness and individuality. And then as a climate communicator, as I went along, I started wondering, oh my gosh, what's at stake with this cherished place if we don't act on climate change? Because here I have captured something so special to me, and these are our homes. These are what we know and love. So I was then motivated to write a second haiku that imagined the future of that state as it will be impacted if we don't act. So the book pairs each haiku together and will hopefully both inspire readers, but also show that we have some work to do.
Yeah. And I think it's so important and so powerful to use both like firsthand experience, like you had being able to go to all the states and then like tying in that creativity to engage people. I think that's such an incredible tool to inspire people to take action. And when I was reading it, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm scared, but I want to take action, right? Not scared, like scared in the sense of like, oh my gosh, I'm paralyzed. It's like, okay, there's hope to still take action, but I can imagine what the future will be like. And this is why we need to act now.
Absolutely. It's kind of like a foreshadowing if we don't do something. And we need to understand that there is some urgency behind it. And to your point, you know, yes, you can be scared, but it's not too late, right? This doesn't have to be the prescription of our future.
Yep. And that's everything we do at the Hopeful Environmental.
Yes, exactly.
A big mix. So for people who might not be familiar with what a haiku is, do you mind just telling us what a haiku actually is?
Of course. So haiku poetry evolved in 16th century Japan, and there are a few stories of how or who actually started the poem itself, but it's likely it began with the aristocracy as a means of entertainment, which is how a lot of poetry and storytelling evolved. Haiku always did capture some essence of nature or seasons, or depicted a specific moment or observation. So they are very immediate in their reflection. And today we know haiku as a three-lined unrhyming poem of 5, 7, 5 syllables, respectively.
Awesome. And so these small poems can have such a big impact. So how do you see haiku, and do you see haiku as a form of activism? And how can poetry, in your view, inspire change or action when it comes to urgent issues like the climate crisis?
Yeah, I really like this question because I think poetry is an underutilized means of connecting with audiences on environmental issues and concerns, and specifically climate change, because as we just touched on, everything is really quite terrifying if you think about what climate change could mean, can mean for coastlines, neighborhoods, animals, entire island nations, ecosystems, you name it. Everything, everyone will be impacted. And that's overwhelming to the nth degree. And this is, again, if we don't act. So pair on top of that, the 24/7 news cycle, and it feels impossible to keep up with everything. But I think poetry can almost be this ethereal expression that takes an existential crisis and processes it for you. Whether you're trying to convey the urgency or need for action, in my case, you can utilize poetry to try to make that message a little bit more clear. Or you may have been impacted by fires that ravaged your home or a hurricane that wiped out your island, and you can turn to poetry to find your feelings. And I think that's a really beautiful piece of art in whatever form or medium you find it. And I also want to reflect on something else that might kind of put it into perspective. And that is, you and your listeners might remember that at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, when it was really intensifying, when we were all seeking a moment of levity, there were memes floating around that joked that climate change needed COVID-19's PR manager, because it was this global problem and everyone was paying attention to it. And you and your audiences are probably well aware that climate communication is extremely sticky, and facts and statistics aren't currently convincing middle of the road or disbelieving audiences. And so I think when we pair poetry, storytelling, emotion, and singular moments all together, this is where we have an opportunity to inspire awareness and action.
Yeah, I love that. And like finding a medium that makes things accessible in a way. And like, you know, I also see the fact that like sometimes there's just like all this information that comes out. And like you talked about, like the news cycle is just, oh my gosh, so scary. All these bad headlines. But, you know, finding a way to still like get to people in an accessible way and say, okay, here's a way you can picture it. You don't have to look at a graph that's like, what does that even say?
Yeah.
here's something that you can see and imagine.
You're spot on. And the word you used was accessible. And I think that is so key to any kind of activism, right? Because what is most important to me might not be most important to a mom who lives in a city, or a teacher who works, you know, hundreds of miles away from me. But if we are able to share stories that resonate, even in just a simple human way, that makes it more accessible for us to understand each other and relate to one another.
Yeah, especially like siloing in our own messages into these echo chambers. It's like preaching to the choir. Okay, I can preach to another environmentalist, but you know, we need everybody. Everyone needs to be involved. So this is a great way to do it.
Absolutely.
So each haiku reflects the climate challenges specific to each state in your book. So can you share how you approached writing these haikus, especially when addressing issues like the loss of natural landscapes or environmental threats, which are such heavy, heavy topics?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think first, it's important to acknowledge that I'm capturing a moment with these haiku, not totality, because if we don't act on climate change, we all are going to feel impacts in a myriad of ways. So my poetry is not intended to showcase the only way a given state or region is going to feel or be impacted, but it is meant to be a moment that will strike you and help the reader to see or consider climate change more concretely. Again, getting to that accessibility piece that we were just talking about. And for me, I started by asking questions of the people I knew or I met in my travels and simply took notice of what stood out to me. It was that relatability aspect for me to think, okay, well, this person's life has been impacted in this way, and I really kind of latch on to that. So now I'm going to put on my former fact checker and editor hat and start doing research. So the second haiku in the series, they were certainly more curated and a little less free in their expression, but they needed to be informed and accurate. And so I tried to find and start with the emotion and then do the information seeking that could really create that poetry that has that staying power.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, when I was reading through the book, and I'm not going to give any spoilers, everyone should be going and purchasing the book. But, you know, I haven't even been to Washington State. And when I read the Washington one of how it has been changed and everything, and it was like, whoa, I felt that so much. I felt them all, but Washington, for some reason, stuck out to me the most. And, you know, again, everyone should go get the book. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's just it's so powerful that your words are able to make that impact on me. And I haven't even been to that state. And it's like, okay, if I wasn't already involved, how do I get involved? Because I don't want that to happen.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. And I love hearing that. And I really loved Washington's as well. And I think each state certainly stood out to me in different ways. And trying to personify the state in some aspects, it lingers with me even now, though I wrote the poems ages ago at this point. I'm just really excited to hear that, because Washington is such a beautiful, beautiful place and has also, just like everyone else, so much at stake here. And I hope that it can, in fact, galvanize readers like you and me.
Yeah. So in your travels, which state or landscape had the most profound impact on you, both personally and as an environmental activist?
Personally is such a hard question because, as I just mentioned, every place stands out in some way, shape, and form. And there are places in our country where I feel so at home, or I stand in complete awe and respect. But one place that stands out to me, perhaps among them all, I hate to use absolutes because, you know, this answer could change tomorrow, but one that I do want to reflect on and give recognition to is when I visited the bristlecone pines in the Sierra Nevada. Now, for those unfamiliar, the bristlecone pine trees are the oldest living organisms on the planet. They are thousands of years old. They are trees at the top of this mountain ridgeline. Within the Sierra Nevada, they can be found throughout, but there is one particular place in Inyo National Forest where the oldest trees currently live. And the oldest tree, Methuselah, is about 5,000 years old, which, if you think about it, this tree has been alive since the Great Pyramids were being built. During the Roman Empire and throughout the Middle Ages, just to be in the presence of these ancient beings was so incredibly profound and made me feel so small and humble that, you know, my short lifespan is nothing in comparison, but also the level of respect for me to think these trees have existed for so long, how selfish it would be of me as a human to create a world that loses them. So that certainly left a mark on my heart, and I will carry that forever. And then you also mentioned as an activist, and immediately I think of my time in Hawaii, where I met people doing research on endemic birds that are going extinct, and they are found nowhere else in the world. And this is happening with many island species all over the planet, and they've evolved over the millennia to be unique to their parts of the world and fit in an ecosystem niche needed there. And the birds in Hawaii that I'm thinking of, they're known as honey creepers. There were once 30 species of them, and now there are 17. And they're dying out because of avian malaria, which you don't necessarily at first see the connection to climate change, but that's because these birds live in different mountain elevations. And above 4,000 to 5,000 feet, the birds are escaping the mosquitoes carrying malaria because mosquitoes can't live in those cooler climates. But enter climate change, and that's where these birds are essentially losing their escape routes. And there's a coalition of government, federal government, state government, and nonprofits working to release modified mosquitoes that can't reproduce. And this stems the population and gives the birds a fighting chance. So these are these pockets of hope and stories of people acting to address what we've created here with climate change. One thing that I will add, though, that is particularly heartbreaking to me is that this coalition, when they know a particular bird species is going to go extinct, they capture a few of them and they put them in captivity to hopefully one day repopulate the species. And to me, that is just so stark that, can you imagine if you are working with the last of its kind and this bird holds its entire species on its shoulders, and this innocent thing has no idea what's at stake. It's just trying to survive and ends up living its last days in captivity because of something we have done. And to me, it's so, so poignant and stark of the world that we are facing if we don't act.
Yeah, no, I feel that so, so heavily. You know, I was working with wolves at a wolf center in New York, and there was like less than 100 of the red wolves left. And we're sitting there looking at this red wolf in front of us, and I'm like, wow, like, you have this weight of the world on your shoulders, and your weight of your species on your shoulders, and you don't even know. And it's definitely like a wow moment. Like, it takes your breath away.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. Yeah, you've seen it up close too. I mean, red wolves are an entirely another story as well. And I think that's the face of climate change in some regards. And having this respect for species is admittedly hard to convey, I think, to some people, but it's just another face of climate change. Yeah.
Yeah. And also like making that connection, like you said, with avian malaria, and people think, oh, it's just a disease or whatever, but it's like, okay, well, this is why it's worsening because of this. And, right. You know, right now I'm working on water policy and, you know, trying to get people to realize that, you know, pathogens and bacteria are happening more and more in our water. We're seeing it more and more. And why? Because of climate change, because of pollutants, because of what we're doing to the environment. And so like making that connection is so powerful too.
Absolutely.
So You know, in the narrative section of your book, you dive into your personal journey. And how did your experiences on the road witnessing climate change firsthand shape your perspective on the intersections of art, activism, and environmentalism?
Yeah, this is also a great question, because being on the road, you have a lot of time to think. Now, I'm one of those people that, yes, I do listen to podcasts when I'm driving and I sing as loud as I can to music, but I'm also very happy to just have silence and be with my thoughts, which is definitely a crazy idea to a lot of people I know. But in that way, I did have the opportunity to reflect on things that I might have just seen. For example, I'm thinking of with Kansas. You know, I visited the state, and at one point there was a dark storm rolling through, and I had the opportunity to just kind of sit and think, what might that have looked like if it's tornado after tornado, because our jet streams are shifting and we're feeling different climate impacts? What would that look like if I lived there full time, if I was the hotel concierge who was so kind to me when I walked into the hotel and was like, are we experiencing a tornado? And she was just so cool and calm about it. She's like, no, not at all. This is fine. But what would that mean for her life if it's every time a hotel guest is trying to check in, she's like, excuse me, we need to go into the basement right now. You know, it's these moments that you don't necessarily think of unless you have the opportunity to sit down and think about it. And so my time on the road definitely impacted a lot of how I approached these poems and then the narrative section as well. But I do want to kind of sidebar tangent just to clarify something, because it's worth repeating. And I imagine your listeners probably already know it. And that is the idea of witnessing climate change firsthand. This is a phrase that we as eco-activists need to be careful when using it around audiences who are skeptical of climate change, because while you and I know that a single weather event is not climate change, the repeated nature, the extreme, the intense weather events that are all happening more often, more frequently, they are a result of our planet changing. So I think there is nuance to acknowledge that seeing the last honey creeper in the wild or watching a Category 5 hurricane rip through North Carolina have indeed been caused by the changes that we're facing due to climate change, but they are not in and of themselves climate change. And that might be, I guess, too, a nice segue to the rest of your question, and that is using, in my line of work, the written word as activism. And so moving throughout the country here, I mentioned in the book, in the Southwest, when I was driving through Arizona, I was just shocked at the number of almond farms I was seeing. Like, this is this water-intensive crop in the freaking desert. It makes no sense to me. It's a foolish use of resources. So, you know, there's nothing I can do in that moment about an almond farm. So I feel kind of hopeless. Well, what I can do is I can take to art, and I can use that to speak out and to galvanize and to raise the awareness. So I think that's a long-winded answer to your question, but hopefully kind of puts listeners into the perspective that I had while approaching this book.
Yeah. I think it's like, you know, like, again, like using that art to create action is so important. And that definitely ties into the next question. But I wanted to touch on one thing when you talked about like sitting with your thoughts and you're driving. That scares me so much, because I lived in North Dakota for a year, and I was like going back and forth between North Dakota and New York, and it was 22 hours and I'm driving.
Oh my gosh.
This is too much. I can't sit with my thoughts. I need music. I have a podcast, and I do not listen to podcasts. I know that's crazy, but I would listen to podcasts because I need something on.
Oh my gosh. Yep. I mean, I think also society has made us all evolve into, we just need to have something on in the background, even if it's just another voice talking, because being alone with our thoughts has become so foreign. And yeah, it's definitely something that I do probably a lot more than even some of my friends realize. Like, I'm just driving to work and it's quiet, like just trying to prepare for the day.
It's one of those moments for me, like when I'm driving, it's just like, oh, I don't know how I got here. I just, because I was thinking too much and I'm like, yeah. I don't know that anymore. So, you know, back, tying it back.
Of course.
With our thoughts. So the beauty of haiku often lies in the ability to capture a fleeting moment. You know, we talked about how they're like these small poems, but they can have so much impact. So how do you balance the brevity of a haiku with the weight of the environmental issues you're addressing in the book?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we started to touch on this earlier. And to me, it's multifold. I want to leave readers with a single element or moment that they can hold on to and reflect on, because the overwhelmingness of existential crises can be paralyzing. And it's not each of our responsibilities to know everything or be experts on a million things. And this is exactly why I wanted to write a short narrative section too, because the poetry itself, yeah, that's three lines. But with each of us going through any number of personal, professional responsibilities, we don't necessarily have the time to spend on an issue that we're not well versed on. And I think a very cool example that I would aspire to be, Neil deGrasse Tyson wrote a book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. And I love it because it's a topic I'm fascinated by. It's super short. I don't have time to become an expert, but this is like just a way for me to understand it enough to have a conversation with some friends or understand a topic that really does matter, but I don't need to be the foremost expert on it. So I think that's one of the reasons why and how I approached brevity in this book.
Yeah, I think that's so important too, because so many people I think are afraid to take action in the climate crisis or even like step into this space because they're like, I'm not an expert. And it's like, you don't need a degree. You don't need to have formal education. You just need to live on the earth.
Absolutely.
Want to take action.
Yeah.
So that's so important. So you spoke a little bit about reflection and the need for reflection and the importance of it. So the book offers a blend of reflection and acts as a call to action. So how do you hope your readers will respond to the environmental challenges presented in each haiku? And what kind of change or dialogue are you hoping to spark?
Yeah, I hope that readers will feel first more connected to their homes. And I mean that both in the state that you call home and our country. You know, America is massive and holds such a diversity of wonderful landscapes and people and animals and flora, fauna, fungi, you know, all of them. We have so much to be proud of in our home country here. And I want the book to resonate with environmental activists and newcomers alike, because perhaps it will inspire a more mindful walk through your neighborhood or your park, or the next time your family visits a national park, you're going to be more aware and respectful of the intricacies of all of the animals you're seeing and the roles that they play in this world that we share with them. And then my next hope is that readers will feel empowered because it creates the opportunity or the fodder for deeper conversations or sparks ideas on ways to join the fight. This comes back to the idea that stories, not statistics, are going to sway action in the way that we need it. So I am hopeful that haiku and hope can inspire, empower, and galvanize.
Yeah, I love that. And you know, what are some ways that we as individuals can begin to connect more deeply with our local environments and take meaningful action to protect them?
Yeah, of course. I'd say first and foremost, take those mindful walks outside without your phone. You know, pay attention to what you see and you hear. Pay attention to the birds in your neighborhood. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, nature is just what we see outside of our bedroom window or living room window. It's not necessarily the beautiful creatures like wolves that you have worked with or bears that my organization works with. So pay attention to the wildlife and the nature that you do see right outside, whether it is a bird or a squirrel. And think too how that creature is the result of eons of evolution. Like, how cool that we are ending up in this moment together. We're both just trying to do the best we can. And the bigger point or takeaway of me saying that is we did not evolve out of concrete and houses. We are from nature. And detaching from technology, I believe, is the best way to connect more deeply with the environment. And don't get me wrong, we got to have our phones. We use cameras. You and I are connecting right now via technology. So it's amazing and awesome. But I think we are in an era where we are all blazing through life without necessarily enjoying the realness of the nature and natural world out there that we originated from. So for people trying to get that connection, just detach for a little bit each day and allow that to open up into greater and broader experiences. And I have so many friends that I've met, some on my travels, some who I've known for years, where they were homebodies and were like, nah, I don't need to go outside. And now they are backpacking ridgelines and trails, and you can start any which way and reconnect.
Yeah, I love that. I think the importance of just connecting, like you said, is so, so important. And just being out there and realizing we can protect what we love. And when you're more likely to love something when you're out there, you know, experiencing it. And I think something for my friends too is in my town, we had this like river and it dried up because we had a bad drought. And I'm in New York, so like droughts aren't that, like we don't get droughts like that without climate change.
Right.
And my friend's like, what is that? Why is that happening? And I was like, well, climate change. And it's like, when we go outside and you're experiencing it and you're seeing it, you're like, okay, when there's a drought in California and we live in New York, okay, that's not impacting me. It's not, I can't connect with that. You can.
Yeah.
It's harder in New York, but when you're seeing it firsthand and you're like, oh, this is what they've been experiencing. Wow. Okay. This is climate change. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. You've just nailed it on the head. It is that immediacy. Once it's in your backyard, then it seems totally obvious, and it seems far away until it isn't.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think is the most important takeaway from Haiku and Hope, your book? And for those who are just starting to engage with environmental activism, or those who are overwhelmed by the scale of climate change, you know, what's a key takeaway that they can get from your book?
Gosh, let me think here.
I know there might be so many.
But I know. Key takeaway, everybody has a role, big and small. And for the sake of our children and future generations, I think we owe it to the future to not plead ignorance or plead that we're too busy, because there are ways that we can all contribute without drastically changing our lifestyles or sacrificing what matters most to us. And I have tried to lay out some of those methods and tools and techniques in the book to make it easy for all of us.
Yeah, that's so important. I love that. And now kind of going, I know we've been talking a lot about the 50 states, but you've also traveled to all 7 continents, which I am so jealous of. I'm super jealous of that. But, you know, through your travels, I'm sure you've definitely seen a lot of beauty, but you've also definitely seen the destruction. So can you describe some of the destruction that you've seen, and then some of the things that gave you hope?
Yeah, absolutely. And well, first and foremost, I'm envious too of some of the things that you've done with your work. So I think it's just great to uplift one another and recognize that, again, we are all part of this environmental journey together. So thank you for everything that you're doing. So let's see. Destruction. Children playing in a very polluted and garbage-filled Mekong River outside of Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Penguins panting, trying to cool off in mud puddles in Antarctica. Meeting the last 2 northern white rhinos on the planet in Kenya. These, to me, paint a picture of what we're doing to our planet, what's at stake. But there is the inverse, because there is always hope. And I went to Cambodia to work with wildlife sanctuaries that rescue sun bears and moon bears from circuses, illegal pet trade, illegal bear bile farms. And then this one sanctuary rehabilitates them and reintroduces them to the wild and or keeps them safe if they're too dependent on humans and can't go back into the wild. And in Antarctica, there are researchers dedicated to understanding Earth's memory as it's preserved in the ice and then informing the world what's at stake. And in Kenya, I had the privilege of meeting the caretaker of these two northern white rhinos. And he knows that there might not be a future for his two rhinos, but he will never give up on them. And that is, to me, one of the most hope-inducing humans. Just because something is lost doesn't mean you stop caring or you give up. You fight with every piece of you because it's what you hold most dear, most important, most valued. And that is what I am driven to do with nature as we know it.
Yeah, that is such an important lesson. And I think, you know, now in the US and everywhere in the world, but especially in the US, you know, we're facing all these bad headlines and these negative headlines. And it's like, okay, but hope is not lost. We've dealt with bad things. We continue to deal with bad things, and we will, but we can also come together and create change too.
It's not over. 1000%. Absolutely.
Yeah. So for people who might feel disconnected from the realities of climate change, or who are new to the journey of joining the activism or joining environmentalism, what would you say to them to help them understand the urgency and importance of preserving our natural landscapes?
I'd say read the book. but you and I just talked about this, right? It is understanding the realities and the urgency and the immediacy. And I think it is very important to point out that climate change has a lot of faces, and most of us have seen some of them already. We just don't realize it is a mask hiding this greater problem. And for me, ultimately, it comes down to a matter of respect. I love this planet. I love this country as we know it. And the Earth will continue to live on with or without humans, right? But the multitude of landscapes, animals, people, and cultures, it's all a culmination of millennia of human interaction with the planet. And right now, everything we value and know is at risk of changing in ways that don't fully support the ways we enjoy living. And there's interconnectedness, as you mentioned, between the clean water that we drink, the foods that we enjoy. Like, there are pollinators that help to create that food. There are animals people don't even know exist that are helping to clean the polluted water. You know, there are so many connections that are there and we don't always see. And ultimately, I think we just need to remember we evolved with and alongside nature. We are part of it. And we just happen to live in an era in the world that we have the ability and responsibility to care for nature. So I think that's about it.
Awesome, yeah. And where can people actually purchase the book and see all of that stuff?
Of course. So the book is available at most retailers now. You can get it certainly on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or if you want to support a small publisher, you can get it direct from Fulcrum Books, but it is right now available from most bookstores and retailers.
Awesome. And yeah, for anyone listening, we'll have that all linked below so people can easily find that in the description of the podcast and description of this episode. Yeah, but is there anything, I know you, something I always love to ask, but I know we talked about it a little bit, but I always love to ask at the end, like, what gives you hope? And I know you've discussed some of those stories that do give you hope, but is there anything else that gives you hope for the future of our planet and the future of humanity?
Absolutely. And I think one thing that I reflect on a lot is that there are a lot of people on this planet, yes, but there are a lot of people on this planet. Like, if we all contribute in a little way, that's going to make a huge impact and difference. So I think just the shifting perspectives that we are starting to see give me hope. And even if right now we are at a place in our world where things are about to get kind of bad, maybe worse, I absolutely have hope. And I know that there are millions of us feeling the same way, that we are going to protect this beautiful planet that we have. So I absolutely think there's no need to despair. We got this.
I love that. I love that. I love it. Yep. There's so many people who care and always do that, holding it with us. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I am just so stoked and grateful to have this conversation with you. And I am so excited to see what more you produce and your team produces in the future, because this is exactly the point. It is sharing these good stories, connecting with people, connecting the dots for people. Like, you're doing it too. And I love it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of the Hopeful Environmentalist podcast. If you're interested in checking out Maggie's book, all of those links are included below. And if you're also interested in signing up for pre-order updates for my children's book, Greeny LaRue and the Earth Crew, you can check out www.greenylarue.com. And for spelling, you can just click the description in this podcast for both Maggie's book and my book. As always, remember to stay hopeful and create positive change.